Professor Bush's mediation class on 26 November
I'm folks, we're supposed to do an evaluation today, but I was told not to do them unless we get 10 students. And we're a couple of short, so I'll give it a couple more minutes, and maybe we got them. Because I know somebody else would be, yes, I think, is that 10?
Yeah.
All right. Let's do this then. 2, 4, 6, 8. All right. Because I know you're just anxious to get class started, right? Okay, folks, for those of you who haven't done these before, you just need to put your CRN number on the scan sheet where it says name. You don't have to bubble in the number. And you bubble in your answers on the sheet. There's another sheet there on the back where you can write any comments you have. Once I give you the sheet, you can go ahead and start. You don't have to wait for me to pass it to everybody. The task force will be coming in at 2:30, so he will start the class then. There will be no break. So if you need to take a break, do it now or immediately after you fill out your evaluation. And please remember, I do need the pencils back. So, did you get one?
I did. Thank you very much.
Any other chance? Sure. Yeah, the CRN number is written on your cover sheet there.
Yeah, that's what he said. If you're talking about your break, he's going to come in at 2:30. He's going to teach straight through. So if you need to, like, you know, use the restroom, grab a cup of coffee, take a quick nap, now's the time to do it. All right, so everybody gave me their evaluations? Do I take that as a yes? Okay. All right. Folks, thank you very much for your time. Are you a day student?
Yeah.
Okay. How quickly can you do it?
Soon.
All right.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, I have everyone's evaluation now, right? You all handed it in? Okay, great. Thank you very much for your time. Have a good Thanksgiving, and good luck on your finals. Thank you.
No, I'm not making this up. No, why do you say? How do you create to celebrate Thanksgiving?
They just do it. Oh, no, I mean, they're doing things. Our news friend, again, let's give her a hand. She puts up with me all the time. Okay. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for your kind words. If they weren't kind, thank you for them anyway.
Now, the truth of the matter is that screen is all set up. The first big surprise is no movies. No movies. We're all done. Sorry. Next week and this week only talking, and discussing, or as Burns would say, moral conversation. Right.
So I can just leave that there. Is that too distracting?
Oh, you know what? We'll just
turn this off.
Here we go. Split.
Oh, that's it. Gone.
Yeah, because I think I want to use the board even.
See if I still know how to do that.
Okay, so the second thing is that I don't have your papers printed. I mean, I only got it Saturday night, didn't I? But they were all wonderful. Therefore, I sometimes say in my classes that I'm going to give poetry candies to people to get the right answers. And since everybody gave a good answer, I'm going to pass those out. Those are brand new. I just opened them up to give a few to Nora's, to Dean Demleitner's children who are here today. So even though they're a little younger than you, I don't really know what's in them. But I don't eat candy. I don't eat candy. I can't. My wife doesn't let me eat candy. So it's a health thing.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure. I give you papers. Your papers were, as usual, for this particular assignment, very inspirational. And did Frances bring this other stuff? Yes, she did.
Okay. So I have a bunch of, that's the other
thing about today's class, and I have a bunch of other goodies for you. I decided to give you the sweetest ones first. But let me also give you these other things, because partly we're going to use them in class. Okay, so I'm going to first give you the things that we're not using today. So just take one, and this is next week's assignment. The first two things are next week's assignment. And they probably will be related to writing assignment three. So make sure you take a copy. I actually am going to email them in a PDF file on the hearing. Some people, I wasn't sure, some people might. I knew some people would be here. So you will get it, but if you have it in hard copy, you don't really need the PDF file. Okay, so that's the first two things. Just put them away. We're not going to get to that today. I'll tell you about it at the end of class. The third thing is a kind of, you know, voluntary follow-up thing, but we will talk about that, I'll maybe a little bit next time, about areas, specific areas where transformative mediation is actually used. And this a little bit parallels chapter 3 of the book, which talks about the model being developed and used in different areas. But these are a series of articles written by other folks mostly about specific applications of the transformative model. And since often people say, like Michelle has asked, you know, well, really, you know, is this, are you serious about this question? Is it, would anybody be crazy enough to be interested in this? So there are some examples of several contexts where people have become quite interested. But that again, don't look at that now, just put it away. Okay?
Okay. Are there enough copies of that of the policies and choices thing? I see I have some others. Yes. Did everybody get a copy of this thing? That one? Yes.
Yeah.
So you should have models and policy choices, confessions of a problem-solving mediator, and I'll talk about that before the end of class, and application for transformative mediation. Now, next is the stuff we're actually talking about today. So this is another article by this fellow Bird, and I hope you brought that between all your materials. This is from the same guy who I gave you a little excerpt from in that handout on reflection. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. And then there is a one-page chart for this. It's going to be the basis for a lot of our discussion today, okay? Well, that stuff is actually for today. Now,
how do you know if these things are working? Oh, it's got a red light on. That must mean it's working, right? And I see the voice. Oh, hello there.
Right. Whoever you are.
You know, why don't we put this over here? Hi. I'd like to meet Dorothy Demleitner's daughter. Yeah? Should we bring her in here and say hello?
Yeah, I think she might. They're on their way out.
Okay. Oh boy, this table is rather unstable. Okay, so where are we today? We've spent quite a bit of time talking about these three different models of mediation, beginning with the stories and then going through the facilitative model, the restorative model, and most recently the transformative model. So at this point, we're like 1 week behind our syllabus schedule. The subject is comparison of models. And the comparison of models sort of continues our discussion of how do these models develop, why are they different. So first of all, let's talk about how they're different. Okay? Now, in the handouts you have there, we're going to get to that in a minute, but let's say that at the most general level, there are two fundamental differences,
we might say, between the transformative model and both of the other two. So we're talking about comparing three models. The facilitative model, the transformative model, and the restorative model. The truth is that in our study, we really kind of looked at what you might see as a fourth model, which could be called the evaluative model. And in a way, the difference between Stolberg and Riskin, even though Stolberg is a self-proclaimed, and surely in the way he writes about mediation today, a facilitative mediator. But, and what's the difference? The difference between facilitative and evaluative is that evaluative mediators generally are not just focused on settlement, but they're willing to offer substantive advice, guidance, opinions about what the parties ought to do. So not only are they trying through kind of promoting more effective negotiation, positional negotiation, to get the parties to a settlement, but they're actually perfectly willing to tell them, well, if you wound up in court, this is probably what would happen. If you make this argument to a judge, you know what, you could leave these for after.
Oh, okay.
And the ones we're talking about today is this and this, and that way you don't have to take more than you have.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Just don't forget to take these three things in. An evaluative mediator is perfectly happy to tell people, look, it goes like one step further than pointing out the strengths of and weaknesses of the two cases, the strengths of the other guy's case, the weaknesses of this party's case. What an evaluative mediator is saying, let me tell you what a judge would do in this case. Let me tell you what I think you ought to do. You really should accept this settlement for the following reason. And that kind of mediation has become quite popular, particularly in court-ordered mediation in large money commercial cases. So there is a huge amount of court-connected mediation today. Court-connected mediation is the fastest growing
kind of mediation there is. Most of the people who do it are lawyers or ex-judges, and they therefore feel perfectly qualified to opine on what would happen in court and to give legal advice, legal opinion, if not legal advice. Nobody who does this kind of mediation is basically anything but a lawyer, more or less. So that kind of mediation has become very, very popular. What does it look like? It doesn't look that much different from what we saw Stolberg doing in the landlord-tenant case, except for the fact that if Stolberg were really an evaluative mediator, he would be telling those people, well, if you go to court, this is what's going to happen. And if you go to court, this is what's going to happen. So this is the settlement you ought to accept. And
he hasn't explicitly done that. But I just want to say we've had a little glimpse. So we saw sort of, we kept saying two versions of facilitative mediation, the positional bargaining version and the problem-solving version. Today, that sort of has developed into evaluative mediation, which is far more like the positional thing we saw Stolberg doing, and facilitative mediation, which is almost always focused on needs and interests, even rather than advice giving and opinions about legal rules. Okay, so we saw these three models of mediation. At the most general level, and I ask you to read for today chapter 7, we could say there's two big distinctions between these three models. And the distinctions could be summarized in saying the distinction is the difference between a top-down versus a bottom-up process in terms of the practices or the process itself. And another way of describing that would be top-down, meaning mediator-driven or controlled, versus party-driven or controlled. And that's talking about a difference in how the process, how the models work, right? How the models work. That's one fundamental distinction. And the second distinction is the distinction between what in chapter 7 is described as conflict containment versus conflict transformation. So, top-down versus bottom-up, containment versus transformation. And the second is really not about how the process is conducted, but rather about the goal or the product of the process. Now, if those are the fundamental distinctions, let's talk for a minute about, see if we can understand a little bit more about what does that mean. So, to go back, even though we're not watching anymore the Purple House, to talk about it a little bit more, we saw really the whole case pretty much. You've read the whole case. So one question I could ask you is, why doesn't Bush the mediator stop in the Purple House at the end of segment 4? So that basically is on page 180 of your book. That's basically when Elizabeth and Julie, with a little bit of help from Bernice, who's been a little bit sort of out of the loop most of the time, or serving a kind of secondary, in a sort of secondary role. Why doesn't Bush, at the end of that segment on page 180, just wrap it up? They have agreed, basically, about what to do about the house. That's what they came for, right? They came because there was this complaint about the house. And by the end of segment 4, that issue is wrapped up. If you look and flip to page 186, that's 180. On 186, that's where this long last segment starts, where Julie says, "I had another topic." And that's when Julie reintroduces the topic of, is she or is she not a racist? Was this motivated by race? And after resisting this for quite a while, and actually even beginning to resist it again then, Elizabeth finally basically agrees to engage with Julie about the question of, you know, why does she think this was racist? And why is she calling Julie a racist? And what does she want anyway about that? Now, I guess the standard question that you would ask about that, and when I show this tape, I always get this question, is why the heck
doesn't the mediator at that point say, look, you know, you did a great job today, sort of like Mayor and Galton would say, you did a great job today, you accomplished a lot, you have a plan for where to go from here with, you know, taking the decision to the board and how you're going to do that, and the details of that have been worked out. You know, the race thing is a really tough thing to talk about. And, you know, why don't you take a break and see whether you really want to go into that. You had kind of trouble going into it before. You backed off. Let's let that go. That's really not something anyway that can be mediated or negotiated. Now, there are plenty of mediators who would undoubtedly, either they would say that directly or they would just find some other reason to stop the session. Why doesn't Bush do that? Why doesn't he, at that point, stop the session? To which there's an obvious answer. I mean, you know this answer, right, in terms of the I'm going to use these papers for an extremely important purpose, right? To keep this stupid table from going up and down the whole time. Oh, that's much better. Okay, a very elevated purpose. Why doesn't Bush do that? What's a simple reason? Why doesn't he stop it? Yep.
Because the party doesn't need
mediation. Say it again?
The party doesn't need mediation, so if they want to talk about it, it's relevant.
Right. In other words, the reason he doesn't stop it is that they don't. They don't stop talking. It is entirely possible, and Elizabeth, and you really never know what people are going to do. Elizabeth might be on the verge of saying, you know, it's such a challenge, I just can't do this, I agree, let's just not go forward. But instead, she says, you know, I don't want to talk about this, and then keeps talking. People always do that in conversations, right? Your boyfriend, your girlfriend says, I don't want to talk about this. But really what I mean is, and then the conversation is like off and running for another hour and a half. So she decides that she wants to talk. So, therefore, Bush doesn't interrupt because this is bottom-up, it's party-driven. It's not, this thing is really very frustrating, but what can you do, right? It really is not up to Bush what to do. And therefore, he follows them. Because that's the whole posture of a transformative mediator, is to follow the parties, not to lead them, not to drive them, not to direct them. But think about this for a minute. Sometimes people say, well, in transformative mediation, you know, do you ever get to, you know, do you ever resolve issues? Is it okay for what are essentially transactional disputes where you need to reach an agreement? So the question is, could Julie and Elizabeth at this point stop and say, you're right, or why didn't say you're right to the meter, just say, okay, that's great, let's wrap this up, we're out of here. Could they do that? What would Bush do if they said that? Would he push them back into the race discussion? No. So the point is, transformative mediation can indeed be, and often is, transactional, in the sense that people come in, what they want to talk about is how to make a deal. And that is what they talk about. So what some people sometimes think, which is that this is a, you know, we have to talk about the relationship issues. That's not true. It's true as long as it's true for one of the parties, but not if it isn't. And sometimes it isn't, sometimes it isn't. And where it isn't, the whole thing turns into a discussion of money, because that's what they want to talk about. And the mediator is helping them to talk more clearly and think more clearly and express themselves more fully to each other about money. So transformative mediation is different from facilitative mediation in the sense that facilitative mediation is pushing for settlement. Right? Transformative mediation is happy to allow and support a discussion that leads to settlement, but it's not pushing. The fact is, the same thing we could say in reverse about restorative mediation. So why didn't Bush, we just said he didn't push them to go into the race issue, but he didn't stop them, right? So why didn't he stop them? Because that was their choice. Why didn't he push them? Why wasn't he the one who said, okay, so now the House discussion is over, but there's another very important thing that you surfaced earlier on that probably it's not a good idea to leave without talking about it some more. Why doesn't he do that? That's probably what Larry would do, right? Even if Larry hadn't done that a lot earlier, which he might have. He surely would have done it. He wouldn't let them get out of the room without talking about it. Why doesn't Bush do that? Then the answer is the same, right? Because he's not going to push them where they don't want to go. If they had, in fact, closed the session there themselves, so he would have said, okay, that's great. You seem to be done for the day. Is that all you want to talk about? Check in? Yes? Okay, great. I hope that was worthwhile for you. So he is also not going to be pushing any more than he would push for settlement and to close down and to stop things from going deeper. He's not going to push for things to go deeper when a settlement has been achieved on transactional or instrumental issues. That's it. That's done. And if they don't want to go further, he's not going to push for it. Although, when they do go further, what does he do? He's right there with them to support that discussion as best he can, which isn't so easy, but that's what he's doing. So, what do we get out of that? In other words, he doesn't push either to stop the race discussion or to have it. Either the mediators in either of these other models, either this one or this one, would have pushed either to stop that part of the conversation or to make sure that it took place. Right? That's a pretty important distinction, isn't it? It's a pretty sharp distinction. He's not going to push for it to happen or not happen. He's going to push for it not to happen. She's going to push for it to happen. So both of these folks are pushing for something to happen or not happen. And Bush is not pushing for something to happen or not happen. He's following and allowing and supporting whatever happens in that conversation. And that's the top-down distinction. Now let's push this one further. Why is it that he's pushing for that discussion not to happen? And she's pushing, I don't mean to be gender biased over here, but she's pushing for that discussion not to happen. And he's pushing for that discussion to happen. She's pushing no race. He's pushing yes race. Why? I mean, in other words, so the first distinction is a distinction of what are they doing this to? Practice distinction, right? There's something different about the practice here than either here or here. The second distinction is not about practice. It's about why is. Why is this person, this mediator, stopping the discussion from race? And why is this one pushing the discussion from race? Both of which are controlling the conversation. And this mediator isn't doing either of those things, but simply allowing and following whatever discussion may occur. So the answer to that can't and doesn't have to do with practice. It has to do with something deeper than practice. Yeah, Allison?
The goal behind the mediation, facilitative, is to come to a settlement. And in restorative, it's to come to harmony. And you're never going to reach harmony if you don't reach that deeper issue.
Right. Well, okay, that's true. But just listen to the way you just said that. In other words, you're absolutely right. That is, whereas in transformative mediation, the goal is neither to reach a settlement nor to reach a reconciliation, but are we any clearer on what the goal is at this point? Can we articulate it any better at this point? I notice you stopped there, Alice. You didn't say that. But in transformative mediation, the goal is, right, what? To change the quality of the interaction, right? To help people change and move out of or through negative and destructive interaction and regain an experience of a positive interaction. Whatever else is happening. That's that at one level, that's the goal. And again, and that's true. That statement as far as it goes is true. But to go back and pick up what you said, which I now can't remember the exact words, it's always the problem. I'll try to clarify some. Okay? These mediators are interested in making a settlement, and these are interested in making a reconciliation, and if you don't push, that won't happen. Right? If you don't push for settlement or limit things, there won't be a settlement. If you don't push for reconciliation or push things in that direction, there won't be a reconciliation. Right? So there is an assumption embedded in that statement, isn't there? In other words, your statement is accurate 100%. About the difference in goals, right? And that's what that says up there. That's the second distinction. So, conflict containment, and there conflict containment comes in two forms. One way of containing a conflict is a settlement. Another way is a reconciliation. Either way, the conflict is over, quote unquote. Right? And this one is a little bit different. It's not about settling or ending the conflict or
through either a settlement or reconciliation, but it's through, it's about changing the conflict interaction, not the conflict itself. So it's perfectly happy. Transformative mediator is perfectly happy if the conflict continues without the parties having reached a settlement, without the parties having reconciled. If his or her goal is that the conflict should be unfolding in a different way, with a different character, with a different tone, right? As the book says at one point, a de-embittered conflict, a de-demonized conflict interaction. So yeah, we're having a conflict. We're still engaged in conflict. We haven't reached a settlement. We haven't reached a reconciliation. But we are not interacting with each other the same way anymore. That's what would look to me like success. As a transformative mediator, that's a little different, isn't it? That's the goal. Changing the interaction, not containing or ending the conflict in one way or another, necessarily. Now, but your statement, to go back, Justice's description, the goal is different now. Your statement went a little further, which is, so if what you really want to do is to get to a settlement or reconciliation, you can't not push or pull. You can't not push them into certain stuff. If you want reconciliation, you can't not keep them from certain stuff. If you want settlement, you have to do that. Okay? Do you hear the assumption embedded in there? There's a couple of them, actually. Do you hear the assumptions that are embedded in your statement? What did you want to say first?
I was just wondering, when we're talking about conflict containment, I guess, versus ending a conflict, because I think that they might be different things, especially depending on what the conflict we're talking about is. Is it the conflict at hand? Is it the underlying conflict? Because the purple house, I mean, it seems like the purple house isn't really even the underlying conflict anyway. And even though if you stopped at the beginning, it would have been more like conflict containment. Like, okay, we're both going to go home and in a small part, you ended this conflict, but you haven't really ended the conflict. It might not be exactly the house, or it might be again. I mean, that might flare up again. Right. You have to change.
That's good. That's good. And that's another reason why the word containment might be better than ending. That's why the word, what does containing something mean? It means like, you know, putting limits on it, putting borders around it, right? So when you get a settlement, there may be other stuff that's still hanging out there, but you've basically, you've cut it off. You've contained it, like firefighters contain a fire. You've drawn a fire line around it. So it's not going to spread, it's not going to continue, it's not going to expand, it's not going to escalate. All of those things are part of containment. Keeping it under containment, keeping it within limits. And the settlement does that, probably. Even if you don't reach the underlying issue, by taking care of this and sort of putting that out of bounds, like out of sight, out of mind, we'll live with that. We don't have to deal with it, but we've at least got this settled. Other people might take a different view, right? They might say, no, you have to get to the underlying issue, right? If you really want to contain this and end it, you have to get to that underlying issue, or that other stuff is going to, like the fire, you didn't put out all the embers. They're going to blow over here, and the thing's going to blow up again. You have to. So containment is through getting to that underlying level, right? It's a different vision of what contains it. But either way, what you're interested in is containing and preventing the further development and escalation of the conflict. Conflict transformation doesn't care about that. It doesn't need to prevent the development of the conflict. As on the contrary, in a way, it's interested in the development of the conflict, but in the development of the conflict in a more positive, constructive, and healthy mode of interaction, wherever it goes. So it, in fact, may spread. Transformative mediation has the interesting impact that it may actually increase conflict. People can come out of the mediation session and wind up having more disagreements with each other, or, you know, new disagreements with each other. Or people can come out having worked out this disagreement and decide that they now feel comfortable enough, competent in themselves enough, and, you know, connected and able to communicate enough with the other party that now they're interested in raising more issues that they never would have raised before. So in a workplace, for example, transformative mediation might actually have the impact of increasing conflict incidences of grievances, because people feel more comfortable about voicing the things that are bothering them than they did before. What do you want to say, Mike?
I was going to say that containment It reminds me of how my parents treated me and my sisters when we were kids. We'd argue, and then it's either find out why we're really arguing or just make us stop. And then when we actually needed to actually argue, we had to do it like away from my parents so they couldn't hear us, because they
right.
immediately come and stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would never get anything. Never explored. It would just be buried.
Right, right, right. And you also, right, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but you might have also wound up never sort of working through your ability to interact constructively, as you argued, as opposed to destructively. So every time a new argument came up, it was the same old blaming, feeling bad, helplessness, hatefulness, whatever, because that never worked its way through. At any point through the whole cycle. Or maybe it did, I don't know. Maybe you did that without them. It was easier without them. There was conscious transformation without an intervener, which is sometimes people, I'm not going to get into that. Okay, so, but you see the difference, right? So, but what's the embedded premise? Let's go back to Allison's premise. But if you do, if this is what you think needs to happen, these two folks on the outside here, the facilitative and the restorative mediator, something needs to happen, right? Either settlement or reconciliation. And if you don't push something or prevent something, that won't happen. What's the assumption embedded in that? Yeah?
That they're not going to come to a settlement or come to a reconciliation on their own.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And there's actually, we can split that into two. That way of stating the premise. You want to say something, Yishai?
I was just going to say that conflict is somehow bad in itself. There's something wrong with conflict that has to be kind of erased, eradicated.
Right, right. That's true. There's something wrong with conflict. So either you have to stop it by reaching a settlement or stop it by getting to the deeper underlying issue. But just to let it go on is not a great idea. That's true. That is an underlying premise there. And what's underlying that? There's something even, that's a pretty deep premise, actually. And it's an interesting thing, because actually when the mediation field, when people started getting interested in mediation, 30 years ago, the kind of rhetorical claim was, you know, conflict is a positive thing. Conflict is a great opportunity. We should embrace conflict, not run away from conflict. As a matter of fact, you clearly see that the embedded premise is that no, conflict has to be contained. And if it weren't negative, why would it have to be contained, right? Why is it negative, by the way? What's so negative about it? I mean, there's another premise there, too. What's fun about premises is that they sort of spread out like tentacles, but they do flow in a kind of a logical way eventually, as we hopefully will see today. What else, why is conflict negative?
I guess because it's destructive and it can only lead to further destructiveness.
Okay, so conflict is sort of inherently destructive. In what way? What are you worried about being destroyed? Are these two guys
or gals, they're both worried. They both think conflict is negative. Otherwise, they wouldn't care about containing it. They both think that negativity, that destructiveness has to be stopped. Are they worried about the same kind of destructiveness? What's the facilitative mediator worried about? What's the restorative mediator worried about? Yeah,
the facilitative mediator is worried about destroying the settlement, destroying the goal.
Yeah, but why? Why is that bad? What's the negative there? Yeah?
The facilitative is worried about destruction of the business relationship. And I guess the facilitative is worried about the personal relationship.
Okay, anybody have a different answer for that? What makes it negative? When you say this is bad, you usually mean it's bad because it might cause X, Y, or Z, right? So sugar is bad because it may make you either sick or fat or both, right? In inappropriate quantities. But there's a notion, bad is not just, you know, oh, it's bad in some absolute sense. It's bad because there's some consequences. What's the consequence? That's one statement. Yeah?
I guess almost in the negative, it's going to destroy harmony. It's almost the opposite of it. So if that's supposed to be a goal, anything that destroys it is probably a negative.
Okay, so who's interested in harmony? which of these two folks are rich in heart? Restored. Right. So if community matters to you, if you think community is important, then the statement conflict is negative is probably the implication of it. The embedded assumption is that if you don't contain this conflict, it will spread and like a cancer and weaken and ultimately destroy the community. I mean, actually, that's not a bad... And that could be a family, right? Some of your papers sort of, you know, describe situations like that. So a conflict between two members of a family can spread. A conflict between two members of a community can spread. And that can undermine the solidarity, the heart, if you want to call it harmony or solidarity, of the whole community. And that's negative. That's bad. And that's why we have to contain it. And when is that important to you? That's important to you when you have a community of some kind. Now, a community could be a family. So this is definitely something which people think about in terms of possible application of family conflict. But generally speaking, you know, in our modern society, many people originally pushed this as the reason why mediation was such a good thing, because it builds and sustains community. And then people came along and said, you know what? What community? We don't have communities. You know, we are an individualistic modern Western culture in which community is you know, it's a fantasy that we have on the movie screen, not in real life. Except certain places. Where would you think that there's a really strong reality of something that you might call a community in our modern American society? We talked about this, kind of come a full circle from the beginning of the semester, yeah? That, no, you have an idea there? Oh, I'm sorry. Anybody have an idea of that? Have you ever lived in a strong community? A strong community is like a community where if somebody's kid is screwing up, anybody in the community will come over and slap them or drag them home for their mom and dad to slap them. Have you ever lived in a community? No, it's very rare in our culture, but there are places where there are communities. I live in a community like that, for example. Religious, tightly knit religious groups tend to live in community, not just Jewish religious groups, Christian religious communities. And in fact, one of the sources, as I think I mentioned to you, as I pointed out to you when we looked at the restorative model, of the restorative model was the Mennonite Christian community in Canada and in the southeastern United States. They gave birth to this model. The other source for that model, do you remember what it was? There were two things pointed to in that article I had you read about the restorative of the Hawaiian and the Samoan people. The Maori people in New Zealand. The Hawaiian and Samoan would be equally true. And in fact, the Ho'oponopono piece at the end of that material, exactly right. So non-Western cultures, not only overseas like Hawaii or New Zealand, but also in this country, like Native American cultures, and in some contexts, immigrant cultures like Vietnamese communities, strong still Chinese communities, strongly knit. Ethnic immigrant communities have real community. And therefore, harmony matters to them. The survival of that community matters to them. And where the community's survival matters, containment of conflict is seen as important, because if a conflict were to spread, that community could be weakened and ultimately fall apart. You know, there are alternatives. People can leave. They can go to New York. They can live in Manhattan. They don't have to stay in the community. And that's a real fear of people who have and believe in strong communities. So the negative is, conflict is negative because it can weaken a community. Now, that doesn't apply. Does it apply the same way, Mike, to a family? A family is, I guess you could say, kind of small community. That's possible. We can even say it there. But a business transaction? That's not a community, is it? That's an arm's length transaction. A business transaction, or a personal injury case, or a landlord-tenant dispute, all of which we saw examples of in on video, right? Or an employment situation, it's not a community. So what's the negative there? We have to reach a settlement, or not that the community will disintegrate, or what? What will happen? Think of a workplace. It's a good way to think about it. What will happen in a workplace if you don't reach the settlement, contain the conflict, draw the fire line around it? That's absolutely true. Productivity goes down. And in the U.S. Postal Service, that was their primary reason
for adopting mediation in the first place, not transformative mediation, but mediation, which were originally they used facilitative mediation before they switched, right? And why would productivity go down? What do you? Let's be more specific. If you don't contain a conflict between two people in a workplace, what are you afraid is going to happen? Yep.
Well, the person is going to feel upset, or they won't do nothing at all.
Okay, you're going to the same thing as he's going. Think more like, how, that's true. That requires a certain level of sophistication for a manager to think that way. What would be your first line thought, yeah?
Maybe that the person will try to spite the other person.
And what will happen? So, what's going to happen? We had a fight, we had an argument over you docked my pay, and therefore what's going to happen next if that doesn't get resolved? Yeah?
Okay.
A fight. Or?
I'm saying that's what your focus is. It's not on your work at all. It's how am I going to...
That's true, but that's sort of the least of it. What the guy above is worried about is that it's going to escalate, right? There's going to be payback. You did this to me, I'm going to get back at you in this way. Or you did this to me, I get my three friends to join in on my side, right? And then you get your three friends to join in on your side. Escalation is very dangerous, right? What could it mean in a workplace? I'm using the Postal Service as my example. It's obvious, right? Somebody goes postal, right? At any level of going postal, meaning there's a fight of some kind. There's sabotage on the work floor. There's some sort of breakdown that doesn't just break up a community, because there isn't any community. It escalates into something really quite destructive. And since there's no kind of community morality to stop that from happening, there's nothing to stop it from happening. Everybody is ready to go to war at the drop of a hat. So what you're really worried about, if you're concerned about settlement, is the prevention of war. Now, the truth of the matter is, if you boot that up to the international level, that's exactly why people send in mediators, right? That's exactly the concept. Send in a mediator. Why? To stop the bullets flying, not the whole community, right? And at the smaller level, the same thing is true, because the world is made up, at least where there are no strong communities, of individuals who are sort of barely tolerating each other at every point in time. And if there's a conflict, there's always the potential for escalation. And if not violence in the simple sense, violent disruption of normal business, of normal interaction, right? Devastating consequences. We've got to stop that. We've got to stop that. So that's, I got off track because you got me to a different premise. And that's the premise of what's negative about conflict, right? What's embedded behind that premise and the other premise? That you have to step in and do something. You have to stop it, contain it, or this negative thing or that negative thing will happen. So let's go back to you now. Because they can't contain it themselves, right? Now that's a different kind of premise. That's not a premise about conflict, right? It's not a premise about what's going to happen if the conflict... It's not a premise. It's not about practices. It's not about the difference of practices. It's not a premise about conflict being negative or about why conflict is negative, the consequences of conflict, the probable consequences. What is it a premise about? What is that premise about that you just said?
The person. It's about your understanding of their capability.
Exactly. Okay, very good. It's a premise about human capacity. Human capacity. So the reason, and the truth is that, again, there are sort of two embedded things there. These people are not capable of either thinking things through rationally for themselves and making, you know, calm, deliberate decisions. That's why we're afraid of escalation and violence. They're also not capable of empathizing, understanding, recognizing each other, and that's why we're worried about community falling apart. May also be why we're worried about violence escalating. So in other words, people lack the capacity on their own, both for rational working out of a settlement and for empathetic reaching of a reconciliation. We're saying that, in a sense, we are pretty pessimistic about human capacities for both self-determination, deliberation, rational thought, and empathy, understanding, and appreciation of the other. And therefore, because human beings have real deficits in the capacity, we're not just saying are they likely, we're saying at some level people can't do this on their own, right? Think back to the little excerpt I gave you from Colbin Kressel talking about what the settlement-oriented mediator thinks. They have to step in there forcefully, otherwise the parties would flounder on their own and settlement would be elusive. Why? Because the assumption is, the premise there is a premise about party capacity. What is the nature of these people I'm dealing with? The answer is that they have really very little ability to pick themselves up by their own bootstraps, and even if they could, recognize, reach beyond themselves to the other person. That's kind of interesting. Given what we've seen the past few weeks, given the Nick Vujicic tape that we looked at, right? And given the stories that you've told me in your papers, doesn't that sound like a strange thing to say, look, mediation of a more directed kind is based on the premise that people don't have the capacity to make empowerment shifts with just being supported and allowed to find their footing again? You have to actually get them empowered. You have to take them in hand. Why? Because they don't have the capacity to do it for themselves. And even if they could do that for themselves, then what they would do when they got back on their feet is what? They would say, I'm all right, Jack, screw you, and walk away from the other person. Because they don't have the capacity for actually identifying with the other person, or as we talked about last week, recognizing a genuine human reality in something that's utterly different from them. People actually can't do that. Their capacity for empathizing with difference, with others who are different, is just very, very restricted. Okay, some comments about that? You had a comment, Maciek, or you just... Mike?
I don't understand the weakness of that argument is so... glaring, because like, were there mediators when we were cavemen? Somehow communities were formed, and you know, some people ran to other peoples, and they formed alliances between nations. And I mean, like, mediation wasn't around since the beginning of time. There weren't like a core of mediators always there.
Who says? Maybe they were. Maybe there were, and they were all transported mediators. Alternatively, what would be the answer to Mike's question? It's a nice question. What would be the answer to that, besides what I just said? Besides that, hey, you guys are doing good on these candies, but there's some still left, and I can't eat them, so I'm going to pass them around again. You don't have to take one. Right on the keyboard. Can I, do you have your watch with you again today?
No, no watch. Okay. No watch. Who's got a watch? I don't
know. Yeah, that's okay. So, yeah, what's another answer? The other answer would be, Mike, you're exactly right. That's why the whole history of human society has been one unending story of war and destruction and violence, punctuated by... You ever hear the 100 Years' War in Europe? You ever hear John McCain saying we're going to have another 100 Years' War in Iraq? The whole thing is war. The survival of human beings as a species is, is really quite improbable. And certainly, since we've had nuclear weapons... It's been essentially, how did we survive the nuclear age? Mutual assured destruction. That's all. Nobody, because everybody's afraid to shoot the first one. Not because people have a capacity for, empathizing with the other. So, this is happening all the time, right? So, I guess the response would say, what's improbable about it? It seems to describe very accurately the whole history of the world that we live in.
But somebody must have, without understanding the transformative model or settlement, they must have just gotten through the conflict on their own.
And by the way, even if we have, there are communities at least, like in the sort of pre-modern era, there were strong communities, right? And people really did at least work out reconciliation, right? Right? And then when they got themselves all together and they were all reconciled and harmonious, what did they do? They turned around and committed genocide on the group next door. That's the whole history of human society, one could say. I don't know if I'm saying I believe that way. I'm just saying that's why you might believe that this is true. That is to say, human beings are inherently incapable, especially under pressure. When things are fine, we can do rational decision making. When things become difficult, we fall to pieces. See the presidential election of 2008 and the economic crisis that produced it. Everybody fell apart, and people are still falling apart. And the stock market has lost half of its value. Is it rational? Is there something that's changed fundamentally about the economy? It's insane. It's totally insane. And before it sanifies or gets sane again, you know what's going to happen? Tons and tons of old people are going to suffer because all the retirement that they thought they had doesn't exist anymore. You thought you were going to move in with your parents. Guess what? Your grandparents are going to move in with you. I'm not kidding. That's what's bound to happen over the next 5 years, because that's going to take 5 or 10 years for this to straighten out. So where's the surprise to any of this? But it's worse than that, okay? It's worse than that, Mike. See, I said there's one premise is that people aren't capable of rationally working things out and figuring out their own solutions. And they're also not capable of empathizing with each other. And even if I can work on my solution, why do I care about you? I don't. In fact, not only don't I can't. I can't understand what the hell's going on with you. So there's a deficit of both rational capacity and empathetic capacity. That's all about capacity. Why am I pushing them or stopping them? Because they can't do it for themselves. They can't think it through for themselves, and they can't understand the other party by themselves. So I have to step in there and help them. Yeah?
I just want to offer maybe a slightly more optimistic
you think I'm being too pessimistic?
No. I think it's fair, but if the premise is wrong, meaning we do have the capacity to empower ourselves, or we have that capacity and to recognize the other, we don't always need a mediator to do that, because we have that capacity.
Right. So that would explain why there weren't always mediators.
Right.
And it may
because
be...
it's a natural capacity.
Right.
If it's a natural capacity...
Well, and it's interesting, and then we could look at the whole social history and say, see, early on they didn't need mediators because they had more capacity. But we've actually, as time has gone on, got worse and worse and worse in terms of our capacities. And that's why today we need mediators. Because we're helpless and hateful. And in the old days, they weren't. They were better than us. Some people might say that too, right?
A lot less people back then too, though.
Oh, see, there were a lot. So there wasn't so much pressure. There was a lot less people, but there were also saber-toothed tigers. The pressures were a little different. There was starvation. There was plague. No. You don't mediate with a saber-toothed tiger. You mediate the people who are together trying to survive the attack of the tigers or the plague or the famine. What do you think scarcity does to human beings, right? We're seeing right now what it does to human beings as the unions and the management of the big corporations are just getting ready to go to war with each other. And the only thing that's preventing them from going to war is what? It's interesting. What's the only thing preventing them from going to war right now? No. I'm talking. GM management doesn't actually have nuclear weapons. Maybe it would be better if they had it and not the guys that do. What's preventing union management and labor from going to war, which we once had in the streets in the 1930s? You guys never saw union wars. You never saw riots, really much of any kind, in your lifetimes. But there are such things as riots in the streets. What's stopping it right now? Yeah?
Forced mediation and forced arbitration?
Not right now. No, the thing that's stopping it right now, yeah?
Bargaining.
It's not really stopping it because there's not even a big pressure for it. What's stopping it is money. Is the fact that the government is printing money and stuffing it into people's pockets faster than they can spend it. $800 billion in the economy. In other words, it's an artificial reduction of scarcity. But that's going to run out. That can't happen forever. That's not going to be an ultimate solution. And soon the scarcity pressures are going to start just like the saber-toothed tigers. And everybody's going to be huddled in a corner. And the first person who reaches for the soup bowl, when that's the only soup you've had for a week and it's the only soup you're going to get for another 2 weeks, that first person is going to find he's missing two fingers. Right? Because scared. I that's a very terrible picture, isn't it? Right. I'm trying to paint you. This is the premise. This is the premise that supports the idea that I have to step in and do it because they can't do it for themselves. But there's another premise. There's another premise besides they can't do it for themselves that might apply even if that weren't true. And that is what? Yeah?
You can do it for them quicker.
Well, that's for sure true. That's an interesting premise, too. If they're so stupid, how am I stepping in there and fixing it up for them? But that's understandable, because you can always see, you know, somebody else's problem and solution better than you can see your own. So a third party, that might, I might be able to make that argument. In other words, if I had a conflict, I'd also need a mediator, right? But it's not my conflict, so I can actually help. But I need to understand when I'm helping them that they're stupid and selfish, basically. That's a way of saying that the premise is real simple. Everybody is stupid and selfish when it comes to their own conflicts, right? So they can't do it for themselves. The other premise is even worse. What's the other premise that's embedded in, I have to step in there and do this? I have to stop them from escalating, and I have to force them to understand each other. What's the other premise? Yeah? Jill?
Even if they are capable of it, they won't do it.
And why wouldn't they if they're capable of it?
They don't want to.
That's exactly right. They don't want to. People don't, and some of you have expressed this yourselves in class, at least, if not in your papers, people don't really care about making their own decisions. If I have a problem, for God's sake, give me a pill. Don't ask me to exercise. Don't ask me to change my lifestyle. Don't ask me to do anything. Yeah, give me a pill. Everybody understands that, right? Yeah, that's why you laugh. And me too. Give me a pill. Fix it for me. Okay, I can do it for myself, but why should I? I don't want to. I have no, that doesn't matter to me, right? Mm-hmm, yeah, that's what you wanted to say. And especially if I, apart from that I don't want to fix it for myself, I sure as hell don't want to care about you. I don't want to do it for myself, and I don't particularly care about understanding you either. I have no capacity for either of those things. That's one premise. The other premise is I have no inherent essential motivation for either of those things. There is no intrinsic motive, power, impulse towards self-determination and empathy or autonomy or understanding. That's something which I may have to do if I'm forced, but it's not coming from within. I don't have the impulse for it. I don't have the motivation for it. And that's the second negative premise that drives both of these. Why do you have to force people to reconcile if really at base they love each other? It should be coming from within. Why at base do you have to, why do you have to force them to reach a settlement and prevent damage to themselves, not just to each other, to themselves? If they're capable and they have an inherent ability and desire to take care of themselves, why do you have to take care of them? The answer is because they have neither the capacity nor the desire nor the motivation. That's really pretty awful, isn't it? That is the picture of what's described in chapter 7. That's the discussion of the ideology behind conflict containment practices that starts on page 242. And that's the picture that is summarized in this chart. This chart basically is drawn from chapter 7, although it contains a column that's a little bit different, which is the restorative column, because chapter 7 sort of simplifies it into two things. So let's look at this chart for a minute. It's going right back the way we just went, if we start at the bottom of the page. Everything that's on the bottom of the page should be, at this point, pretty self-evident. And it's also described in chapter 7 in somewhat more beautiful prose. If we look at facilitative mediation, look across the three columns, right? Practices of the facilitative mediator, the mediator controls and drives the process. Same thing for the restorative mediator. Mediator controls and drives the process. Now they start to change, right? Facilitative mediator, how does she drive it? Limits emotion, excludes intangibles, neutralizes and softens expression, right? Whereas the restorative mediator presses for emotion and catharsis, right? Presses for admissions of responsibility, which is really a total intangible, right? Encourages confessions and apologies, right? and forgiveness. Whereas on the other side, the facilitated mediator is pressing to reframe positions to needs and interests and press for not apologies and concessions, but apologies and forgiveness, but not confessions, but concessions and movement. Right? So, did we see this? Is this an accurate picture of what we saw? We saw it on the screen. We saw it on the page. In the middle, we have something that looks very different. Very different practices. Parties control and drive the process. The mediator allows and supports, but doesn't force emotion. Allows and supports, but doesn't force intangibles. So you can have a completely tangible-oriented mediation, a transactional mediation. House, but not race, if that's where the parties go. Reflects expression without softening. Sharpens difference. That differs from both of the others. Doesn't look for common ground. Doesn't look to emphasize mutuality, but sharpens difference. And privileges party choice, never supplants or pressures about anything. So the middle practices are different from the ones on the outside. We agree on that? That's what Chapter 7 says in more detail, but that's what we've seen. What I'm doing today is sort of driving us up by asking the question, why are these practices different? Which we've also talked about at the first level, which pushes up one step from the bottom of the page. We all looking at the same page? You're looking at me, but I'm looking at my page. Good. Okay? Which is, why the practice is different? Because the goals are different. Okay? The goal of facilitated mediation, production of a reasonable, fair agreement that settles the conflict. And I'm including reasonable and fair, so it's not just pure Stilbergian, a settlement no matter what. Reasonable and fair. On the other side, restoration of harmony, balance, integration of the individual and the community. Preservation of the community. Harmony. Right? In the middle, and now what's, okay, and in the middle, transformation of the conflict interaction. Even if there's no agreement or unity, a different kind of conflict, a different kind of interaction between people who are in a different state, each one of them in a state of strength and responsiveness instead of a state of helplessness and hatefulness. Now, again, on the outsides, those two are basically quite similar in that they're both different kinds of conflict containment. Produce an agreement to stop the conflict, to avoid spread, escalation, cancer. Produce an agreement to restore harmony, prevent spread, deterioration, destruction of the community. In both cases, we're drawing fire lines. We want to end the conflict because, as you properly pointed out, Yishai, the assumption is that conflict is a negative social force. It's going to create devastation and war on the one hand, it's going to create destruction of the community on the other hand. It's a negative social phenomenon. Conflict is a negative phenomenon, right? Whereas in the middle, transformation of the conflict action interaction, no, conflict is not necessarily a negative phenomenon at all. And there, the goal, therefore, is to help people shift that phenomenon from a negative form to a positive form and then let things unfold. We don't have to presume the outcome. Now, if we push further and we say, well, why is that the goal? Why is that what you think is something worth doing? Why do you think that's something worth doing? I want you to start to think about how does this relate to you as lawyers. As lawyers, you're going to be practicing, at the bottom of the page, doing certain things. Your practices as lawyers probably should be based upon some sense of a goal. What is it that you're trying to accomplish as a lawyer? Are you, as a lawyer, trying to, apart from make a living, are you, as a lawyer, trying to help individual clients accomplish their personal life goals? Or are you, as a lawyer, trying to use the cases that individual clients bring you to leverage social change? President Obama graduated Harvard Law School. And then he went to work as a community organizer. Not a lawyer. Actually, he went to work as a lawyer, I think, first. And then as a community organizer in Chicago. And then he decided that wasn't working, that wasn't effective enough for what his goal was, and so he became, he got involved in politics. What was his goal? His goal was change society, just like the campaign slogan, right? Time for a change. What do you mean? Time for a readjustment in terms of social justice. That's obvious through his whole career. There are lawyers who didn't decide to become community organizers or politicians or presidents. They stayed lawyers. And their whole career was aimed at the goal of changing society as a whole, not pursuing the life goals of individual clients. And these are two different things, two different kinds of legal practice. The practices of social justice lawyers are, in some ways, quite different from the practices of transactional lawyers who work for Du Bois, Plimpton, and whatever it is, Paul Weiss. They're not the same practices because they're not just because they're not working for the same clients, but because the goals that they're trying to accomplish demand different practices. And therefore, their practices are going to be different. Family lawyers who are trying to help people to survive as families and emerge intact from divorce, for example, or death of a family member or something like that, their practices may be still different than either one of those, right? So the practices that you engage in as a lawyer are going to be driven by your sense of why is what I'm doing important? What's the importance of it? And if you don't have a sense of that, you know, you could be the best. Actually, you probably can't. If you don't have a pretty clear sense of what your goal is, not in this case, but as a lawyer, you will probably be a pretty shoddy practitioner. Your sense of the importance of a goal. This is what I do for my clients. That's what drives you to become a good practitioner. Because then you say, you know, okay, well, are my practices being as effective as they possibly can in achieving that goal? Right? That's why people who are facilitative mediators will look at Bush in the Purple House tape and say, this is a crappy mediator. Because the stuff he is doing is absolutely incapable of accomplishing what we think is the goal that matters, which is producing a settlement. And you know what? They're 100% right. Because if you did that, thinking that the most important goal was to help people reach a settlement within a defined period of time, I would also say you were incompetent. But that's not my goal. That's not what I think is important. Right? So now my practices are different. When you start practicing law, if you practice without a sense of what the goal of, not this case is, the goal of your professional enterprise, of being a lawyer, in what way are you serving clients? How do you understand that? If you don't have a clear picture of that, you won't be clear enough about what's going to help and hurt that goal to become a good practitioner. And you'll just stumble along, you know, pulling a bunch of stuff out of a hat that you learn at CLE seminars from people who are doing what they're doing to make a buck off of you. Not everybody. Not everybody. But what seminar do you want to attend? What practices do you want to enhance? How can you tell that without knowing what your goals are? I want to help families to be healthier families. I want to achieve more justice for poor kids who get stuck in the juvenile justice system. I want to help deal makers make deals and therefore increase overall productivity in society and help America become a better and richer place. Whatever. What are your goals? Without that, your practices are just all over the place. The practices listed under each of these three goals are very, very clear and coherent. That's the way we've looked. That's why I said every mediator we've watched has been a talented, thoughtful, deliberate practitioner who has a conception of what his goals are and is going after those goals in a very precise way where I can explain everything I do in terms of, here's why I do this, because it achieves this goal. And here's why I don't do that, because it frustrates that goal. Bush can explain that about what he does, and so can Mayer and Stolberg about what they do, even though we do very different things, right? But then the next question, which doesn't answer that question, why do you think that's important? Why is your goal, what you think is your goal, what makes you think that matters? You obviously must think it matters, right? Have you ever asked yourself why you think it matters? Why should families stay together? Why? Is it, why is that important? Some people don't think it's all that important. Why is it important that there should be more rather than less justice? Why is it important that we should have, you know, more equal society? If we could lift all boats up, right? So what difference would it make if some were still filthy richer than some who are much poorer? As long as everybody collectively is richer. What do we care about equality? Why don't we just care about wealth creation? Right? Sound familiar? Reagan versus Clinton. These are not just differences in goals. The question is, why do you hold the goals you hold? What makes them important? Is that a fair question, you think? I'm challenging you in this course about mediation by showing you that people who take different approaches to mediation not only have different goals, it goes further than that. Because those goals matter to those people because of what they believe. They have different beliefs. This is a kind of an interesting and important point. That ultimately, professional practice implicates our beliefs. Not our kind of life strategies, but our fundamental beliefs. About what? For one, about, let's say, social phenomena like conflict. Is it a positive thing or a negative thing? That's not an empirically demonstrable thing. See, Mike, this is where we get in here. Because your argument, which was like an empirical argument, right? I can argue with you and say, no, it's been negative forever. And we're just lucky we're still alive. And you can say, no, Professor Bush, you're crazy. It couldn't be like that if we were really like that, right? At a certain level, empirical evidence doesn't resolve these questions. Are human beings, is conflict negative or positive? You can interpret the facts different ways, right? What makes me interpret them one way and you a different way? Why do I think it's negative and you think it's positive? Actually, I don't think it's negative, but I'm just pressing that point today, right? So, every time you come to a premise about belief, if you keep asking yourself the question, why do I believe that? There is a deeper belief underlying it. And that's what the top of the page here summarizes, which is also in Chapter 7. So if we work back up from the bottom in the top half of the page, which is about premises, that's another word for beliefs or assumptions. We start with something that basically summarizes this distinction right up here. Okay? The distinction that...
Oh, I put it over there. This is about conflict containment, and so is this. And this is about conflict transformation. So that, we could say, is a premise about what is the point of conflict intervention? What is the aim of conflict intervention? So this comes very close to me saying, what's the goal? Right? It's just putting it at a more general level. The goal here is settlement. The goal here is reconciliation. Both of them are different versions, as I tried to suggest before, of conflict containment. The goal of transformative mediation is a change in the quality of interaction. That's not about containment. It's about changing the conflict, not containing it in any way in particular. So when we move up from purpose of goal to that next row across, it's basically the same thing, right? What's the focus of your intervention? What are you trying to do as an intervener? If you move up, we start seeing, why am I doing that? Why am I doing that? So the next column says what? It says, what do you think about, what's the relationship between conflict and other and social interaction generally? Okay? What's the relationship between conflict and social interaction? The general point here is conflict is what? On one hand, we can say conflict is inevitable, right? Why is both of the outside columns
think that conflict is inevitable. Conflict is inevitable, and it's, on the one hand, a necessary evil. Why? Because social interaction is inevitable. We have to interact with each other as human beings. When we do, we're going to get into conflict, right? So conflict itself is inevitable. When we get in conflict, which is inevitable, social harmony is threatened, right? And then let's go up one more. And therefore, conflict is negative. That's where the negativity comes from. It's negative because it disrupts social interaction and or it disrupts harmony. And both of those things are necessary. We have to have, on the one hand, social interaction. On the other hand, for restorative folks, we have to have communities and harmony in them. And conflict disrupts both of those. What's the difference between the premise and the middle? Conflict doesn't disrupt anything. Conflict is actually a useful form of social interaction. It's not disruptive. It's not disruptive at all. On the contrary, it's actually a very useful kind of social interaction, which is why it's not necessary or wise to get rid of it, to contain it. What you want to do is harness it. What you want to do is transform it from something negative to positive. But it has an inherently positive quality. And that's what it says in the next row above, right? I'm just working logically through my own premises and others. In the facilitative view, conflict is negative, like we just said. Why? Because it disrupts social interaction. It's explosive, volatile, and harmful. That's why we have collective bargaining laws, Anna. That's why we have mandatory mediation. Because if you didn't step in, and by the way, those people practice a form of facilitative mediation. Why? Because if you didn't do that, you know what was going to happen? You'd have riots in the streets. You'd have blood in the streets. And on the other hand, on the other margin, in the restorative view, conflict is negative because it weakens community. By the way, there's another reason it's negative, which is it's not virtuous behavior. There's an inherent moral overtone to restorative justice theory, as you remember from reading that article on restorative justice. So we don't want conflict to continue because in the facilitative view, if it does, it will disrupt social interaction and actually wind up creating violence of one form or another. It could be physical violence. It could be commercial violence. Price wars, predatory pricing, trade wars, war. Very common rhetoric, very common language used, right? Even if it's not actual war. And on the other hand, conflict is negative because it's going to disrupt and destroy our community. What's the difference in the premise in the middle, the transformative premise? Conflict is positive, or at least potentially a positive. It's not necessarily destructive. It can be, but it also can be potentially constructive. Constructive, not destructive at all. That's a very different idea about conflict. So now my whole attitude towards conflict is different. I'm not interested in containing it. I'm interested in finding a way to help it move from being potentially destructive to more constructive. Right? What could be potentially constructive about conflict? Why would anybody think that? Why? Okay, yeah. Can you say more about that? Would you like to?
Without the conflict, you may never get a chance to truly understand where the other person's coming from.
What was positive about Nick Vujicic's being born without limbs? How could you say that was positive in any way?
It's positive because the strength that he had to overcome the difficulties had been used to kind of shed light on a lot of other people's lives.
Before that, don't jump over empowerment, Brad. Don't jump over empowerment. Nick Vujicic is born as a normal person, right? No. Does, if he were. If he were born as a normal person with arms and legs. You think Nick Vujicic would, is it likely that he would ever have discovered within himself the kind of strength and determination and will and capacity that he has?
No, but I also don't think that the kind of strength and will and determination and capacity that he has would be as motivating to other people if they wanted to confess it.
That depends. It depends on what that other person had gone through in his challenges. Point I'm making first is we say, what's positive about conflict? Again, why I'm using that analogy, conflict is disabling, right? It is, at least initially, potentially disabling. It hits a person like a challenge of a disease or a disability or a tragedy in life. None of us should face any of them. And therefore we would say, what's good about that? What's good about having a Down syndrome child, right? And yet, when you ask the parent of a Down syndrome child what's good about it, they say, I never would have been exposed to the possibility of understanding what human beings are capable, myself included, in terms of my patience, my commitment, my this, my that, if I hadn't had this child. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I had within me. Within me. I didn't know what I had within me. So what's a positive thing about conflict? Like any other disability, it creates the possibility for a person to discover levels of strength and agency and determination that they might never have otherwise discovered. That would have remained untapped for their whole lives. And therefore, that's positive. That's what positive. Plus, besides that, that's your second point, if I hadn't been put in this situation of conflict, and actually conflict does this better than almost any other kind of disability, because in conflict, the challenge, the disability is not a disease. It's not an external circumstance, an impersonal circumstance. It's another human being, right? So my enemy is another human being. You can't empathize with cancer. It's not you. It's not another human being like you. You can't, you know, empathize with a depression. I don't mean your own depression. I mean the one like we're, God forbid, moving towards, but hopefully won't get to. You can't empathize with it. But a human being like you, you can empathize with, even though they're the one who caused you this challenge. And therefore, you also have the potential to discover the depth of your not just ability to connect with another human being, your desire to. The depth of your desire to understand and connect with other human beings, even when they are utterly different and opposed to you. Conflict gives you that chance more than anything else. It's great, it's easy to be saintly, to love everybody, when nobody does anything bad to you. Right? The first time you really find that tested is when somebody kicks you in the neck. All of a sudden, you find out, okay, yeah. Are you serious or not? About, oh, I understand everybody. Oh, I really feel connected to the whole human race. And then it turns out you feel connected only when there's no price at all to pay for it. But when there's a price to pay for it, now all of a sudden that connection begins to, is this part of who I am or not? My sensitivity to other human beings, is that really part of me? Or is it just a fiction? The potential, the positive of conflict is, in other words, the ability to discover something about ourselves and each other that otherwise would be basically hidden, dormant, not there. It wouldn't be actually revealed. However, there's a deeper premise underlying even that, and that's the top of the page, which really begins this whole thing, right? Which is, why do I think that a conflict is going to help me discover who I am and who you are, Brad, in a positive way, as opposed to basically wind up leading to you and me potentially killing each other? As, not potentially, almost certainly, unless somebody steps in and stops us. Why do I think one thing rather than the other? So the answer to that is the first and deepest premise of all, which is, what do we think about ourselves and each other as human beings? Are we saddled, as the first thing on both outward margins says, with deficits? Or are we nourished with infinite supply of the right stuff? So the deepest premise behind the facilitative approach says, we are essentially separated and isolated beings who desire self-satisfaction to satisfy our desires, but who are defective in our capacity for doing so, because we're imperfect thinkers and even less perfect feelers. We can't think clearly, not under stress, and we surely can't empathize well with other people. And it's not our fault. We're hardwired that way. That is our nature. Our nature is a deficit of rational and emotional capacity. Most of the field of psychology is based on this premise. Most of it. There is a new branch of psychology called the psychology of well-being, or positive psychology, which has challenged this. But for decades and decades, this has essentially been the theory of most behavioral and cognitive psychology. Human beings can't, not that they don't, they can't think clearly or empathize effectively. And it's not their fault. We're hardwired that way. These are, think back. Do you remember what we read about the underpinnings of modern negotiation theory and therefore modern facilitated mediation theory? Cognitive biasing, right? Strategic and cognitive barriers. Where does that literature come from? From the field of psychology. From the notion that human beings have deficits, both in you can't rationally think your way through a crisis, and you can't effectively empathize with the other person who's the other side of that crisis. On the other end of it, think back to the brief stuff that I had you read about restorative justice. What's the assumption about human beings underlying restorative justice theory? The assumption is that although we are, in our various communities, part of an integrated whole, and we want to be, we want to preserve our community, we want to have a sense of unity and belonging, but we are inevitably drawn towards selfishness, envy, hatefulness, all of which are different forms of sin. Bless you. Kate's not here, so you're subject. That's what I call empathy. Kate's not even here, and you're sneezing for her. So the restorative theory, which is based on a certain kind of religious orientation, is also a deficit view of a human being. Human beings are essentially selfish, God bless you, and envious, selfish and envious, and weak. And that's not their fault, right? Both of these deficits, whether it's the facilitative or the restorative view, can be overcome from the outside. We can be shored up from the outside, whether it's by our teachers, or our lawyers, or our doctors, or our pharmaceutical companies, or our mediators. We can be shored, or our religious leaders. We can be shored up from the outside. But it's a constant struggle. It's a constant struggle. It's like rolling a rock up a hill. You've got to keep pushing that rock, or it'll roll right back down over you. And that's the deficit assumption of human nature that's underlying both of these other views. What's the assumption in the middle? The assumption of the transformative view is human beings are definitely capable. By the way, let me stop for a second. In other words, the notion of the underlying, I'm not sure that this is absolutely universally true. There is a kind of static quality to the view of the human being that's embedded in that's all the way down at the bottom of the facilitative and restorative model, which in the book is described as the individualist versus the relational ideology or set of beliefs. What do I mean static? Individualist ideology doesn't believe that human beings are ever not going to be incapable of rational deliberation by themselves and empathetic connection with others. That's not going to change. That is who we are as human beings. We've evolved that way over millions of years, if you believe that. Or we were hardwired with that deficit, if you believe something else. Either way, we're never going to change. And therefore, we're always sort of coping with trying to prevent the horrific consequences of those deficits from emerging. That's what conflict containment is all about. Now we can work our way back up the scale. That's who we are. And therefore, conflict is negative because it threatens to be volatile, dangerous, explosive, and destructive. But conflict is always going to be happening. So what do you need to do? You need to intervene in ways that contain it. And that's why conflict containment becomes the goal. That goal may be seen differently depending upon what it is that you think it has to be maintained and contained. But you're not getting away from containment because we're not going to change human nature. What is the transformative theory basically saying? It's saying human nature is actually not static. On the contrary, true, we are obviously, and there's plenty of evidence to show this, we are inclined to weakness and selfishness. That is to say, we're inclined to be irrational. We're inclined to be incapable of thinking clearly. We're inclined to go to pieces in a crisis, as we've talked about. We're also inclined to think of no one but ourselves, especially when there's a contest involved, and be totally self-centered. We're inclined to both of those things. But that's not a hardwired thing. Rather, there's a developmental potential that's also hardwired into us, which is that we have the potential to shift into strength and connection, autonomy and responsiveness. We have a capacity, and not just a capacity, but a desire. We have a capacity to get out of that deficit state, and it's also part of our inherent human nature to want to get out of that deficit state. That goes back to the notion of transformative theory that people really don't want to be in a state of negative conflict because the experience of helplessness and hatefulness is fundamentally antithetical to their sense of who they are as human beings. What does that presume? They have a sense of who they are as human beings. And they can be this way, but they don't have to be, and they don't want to be. And they know that all by themselves. And therefore, there's already the tools to move out of that and the impulse to use those tools, in which case we can work our way back up the scale. So therefore, conflict has that positive potential. And conflict interaction not only isn't negative, but it's an amazing opportunity for people to do that. It's almost like a gift. Just like Nick Vujicic saw, ultimately, his disability as a gift. He says that in that tape, right? Wouldn't it be interesting if we saw conflict, if we could experience conflict in our own lives, right? As a gift, right? And the transformative view says people actually do at some level see it that way, and if you tap into it, then you can intervene and help them to take advantage of that opportunity by engaging in conflict transformation, not containment. It doesn't have to be contained. Okay, this is all gotten very philosophical, right? What do you believe? What do you believe about who, not even who you are? You're going to be a lawyer and you're going to have clients and they're going to walk into your room. When they walk into your room, you're going to believe something at this very base level about who they are, what their capacities and motivations are as human beings. If you're a divorce lawyer, are you going to believe that that woman sitting in front of you is a pathetic, weak, nothing, who, number one, could never really work this through for herself if you didn't take her in hand, and number two, is incapable, probably, of not hating the you-know-what out of her husband, and therefore you have to kind of tamp that down to make sure this doesn't explode. Is that what you believe about her? Or do you believe that she is somebody who is essentially, you know, beset by selfishness and envy and, you know, a tendency to everything that would not be considered a virtuous quality in a human being, and you have to kind of leash that and prevent it from destroying her and her husband and her children? Or do you have a different view? You have a view that she is somebody who's facing a difficult situation and therefore temporarily has fallen into a state of helplessness and hatefulness, but doesn't have to remain there and doesn't want to. And the question is, how do you help her access the part of her that is neither helpless nor hateful? How do you do that? That would lead you to behave probably, I don't know how, it would be interesting to think about how, wouldn't it, differently as a lawyer. It might lead you to interview her differently. It might lead you to think through her case differently. It might lead you to represent her differently in court. It might lead you to question opposing witnesses differently. It might lead you to do everything differently. And you are carrying, whether you think about it or not in advance, you are carrying with you into that meeting assumptions about who she is and what she wants that don't come from her, that come from inside your head about what human beings are and therefore what they're likely to be capable of and wanting in a divorce or a business deal or a labor management interaction or any kind of representation that you undertake. So that's the translation. This isn't just about mediation. This is what I have looked at and know a lot about. But this is not just about mediation. Now let's take just 2 minutes and then we'll continue next time to talk, to relate this to Burns. And since we didn't get too far into this, we just have this little, and I don't know if you really still have it with you, we have this little excerpt from Burns that I gave you as part of your thing on recognition, right? And in that excerpt, who is Burns? Burns is a legal ethicist. He writes about the ethics of the adversary system. Burns also, and you can add this to your readings for next week, Burns also became a mediator in a community mediation center about 20 years ago. And the article that I gave you, which I said we'd talk about today and we didn't, which is this little excerpt from his article, tells a story about a case that he mediated and talks about the women who are a lot like, in a way, Julie and Elizabeth, although it's not about a Purple House. It's about money and rent. But what's interesting is the way he understands what happened in that case. So read that for next time. That article eventually produced about 10 years later the article that I gave you an excerpt of, in which Burns introduces the idea, he actually refers to it in this piece too, of quote-unquote moral conversation. And talks about the difference between moral conversation and two other kinds of conversation or interaction, political and legal. And he says, moral conversation is a very unusual thing. And its difference from the other two, political and legal conversation, or discourse, which is just a fancy word for conversation or interaction, its difference primarily is that in political or legal interaction, one person is relating to another person as a means to an end, as an instrument to some end. So if I'm doing a deal with you, Mike, as far as I'm concerned, you're important to me as a means to get the deal out and the goods that are in that deal. If I have the same view of a divorce, if I'm dealing with you as my soon-to-be ex-spouse, I'm dealing with you in a way, maybe nice, maybe harsh, but the whole point is you're an instrument for me to get my kid or the time I want. Or the piece of property that I want out of our marriage, right? You're a means to an end. That's possible to imagine in both political and legal discourse. The difference is, in political discourse, there are no rules. I use you, I use instruments. You know, I use a computer to scan a copy of the scan that's sent and a computer to send it to. It's an instrument. And in political and legal discourse, I use you as an instrument to get what I want. Legal discourse, I do it by sticking rules in front of your face, or in front of the face of some third party who has control over both of us. And in political discourse, I use it by essentially forcing you to do certain things that I want you by applying pressure of various kinds. So generally, political discourse is a matter of force, pressure. It doesn't have to be political pressure. It could be moral pressure. Religious dispute resolution is often a matter of political discourse, basically. Saying, you have to do this because if you don't, I'm going to make you feel ashamed of yourself. And I'm going to humiliate you in front of all these people. That's a kind of force, right? Legal discourse is usually using you as an instrument for my gratification through persuasion, either of you or of some third party. I'm showing you logic, how you want to give me what I want. But you are a means to get an end that I want. Moral discourse, Burns says, is different from both of those. Why? Because in moral discourse, each person is regarding the other not as a means to an end, but as an end in herself. In other words, I'm interested in you not because I want something out of you for me. I'm interested in you because I'm interested in you.
I'm interested in who you are. I'm interested in who I am. But I am not interested in getting anything out of you other than knowing who you are. Now, and it may be that in finding and trying to figure out who you are, I also begin to find out who I am. And that also goes back to this notion of the difference between static and developmental. In political and legal discourse, I'm using these instruments to get what I want. I know what I want. I already know what I want. That's predetermined. I know the things that make me feel good, and I'm trying to get them. That doesn't change. That's just my package of people. It's different from everybody, but that's what it is. In moral discourse, there's an assumption that I don't really know what I want. As a matter of fact, I don't really know who I am. The way I find out who I am is by interacting with you, with the world in general, but especially with other human beings. Until I do that, and only through doing that, do I actually begin to find out what I care about, what matters to me, who I am. And that's, which is to say, I don't start with a given fixed package and just find ways to gratify it. I start with a kind of struggle to define and understand and develop my sense of who I am. And I do that in relation to you. And that's what moral discourse is about. So Burns, interestingly enough, talks about this case. This was long before transformative mediation was ever written about. This is the same year I wrote the first article I ever wrote about transformative mediation. He didn't read it. He doesn't cite it. And in the piece that the excerpt that I gave you comes from, he's specifically talking about transformative mediation as a form of moral discourse. How does that fit into what we talked about today? How does that implicate our understanding of different models of mediation? Okay, we'll continue that discussion next week. I want to thank you all for extending yourselves, I really mean, to come here on Thanksgiving Eve. What a, you know, you really do deserve a prize for that, and hopefully you ain't all that candy. But apart from that, the prize is my gratitude. And I hope that it was worthwhile, even if they haven't totally tied things together. You see, there's a larger context for what we're talking about. I want next week to tie that larger context to something very practical, which is going to be your third writing cycle. And that is, if mediation takes all these different forms, how do we regulate mediation? How do we define what's good and bad mediation, what's ethical and unethical mediation? That's what the other assignments are about. So if you read that Burns article, please. And then this piece about models and choices is the piece that you're going to use as the basis for writing assignment 3, and we're going to start working on it together next week. Also, the other piece on professions of a problem-solving mediator, there are actually 2 essays in here written from 2 utterly different points of view, facilitated and transformed. And that's going to also be part of our discussion next week. So have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And I hope that I've stuffed you with my curtains. And I will, God willing, have your papers for you by the time we meet. We meet next Tuesday, right? Next Tuesday, because Tuesday is a Thursday. We meet Tuesday at 2 in this room. Everybody knows that, yes? I will see you there. No more movies, unless I have a brainstorm between now and then. No more movies. Monday is a Thursday.
Tuesday is a Wednesday.
Tuesday is a Wednesday. And Monday is a Thursday. If you understand that, you're able to do me. Have a great Thanksgiving. It's a little more structured than we normally are. You know, sometimes structure helps.
I'll send you an email.
I don't know exactly how really I'll be coming in. Why don't you send me an email? Look at this. This stuff worked pretty good. I don't know if it's good readings, but it really helps for tables.
Good for something. At the very least.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll send you an email.
Send me an email. Sounds good. Marissa, you missed the evaluation.
Oh.
You have to go do it someplace.
Okay.
have her own telling
me
that
she
has Nigerian food
and
her dress. Good, you're very assertive about that. You may not, might never get your watch back.
No, I'm not. It's not bad. I'm just hoping for my class.
That's okay. You need that watch. Hey, come on, come on, come on. Somebody eat that last candy over there. Come on, you shy. Can't do it. Marianne, I'm not going to ask Marianne to do it. I know she's...
You leave it here, somebody's going to handle it.
Somebody's going to handle it. They won't even know where it comes from.
I have to tell them
what it is. One
last
bread.
You've never heard of Chuzai?
Yeah.
I thought that was like the staple go-to, like...
And I have an answer. I always have an answer, right? Whether or not I have an answer, I have an answer.
I, for family law, with Bill, we did a mediation exercise with the mediation clinic.
Yes, 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 I know that.
I had to play a lawyer in the mediation.
Let me just do this before I forget who's here. Go ahead, no, talk, it's fine.
And I was just confused about how a lawyer would fit into a transformative mediation.
That's a great question, isn't it?
Because it was really confusing, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't feel like I fit.
You were the family lawyer.
I was for the husband, yeah.
Okay.
And then the wife also had a lawyer.
So, I mean, it's a very interesting thing to think about, isn't it? What would you say? Just, you know, like, what would be one thing if you were... It's a transformative mediation process, right?
Right.
So this probably means, and I hope... Are you guys waiting to ask me something?
I wanted to ask you a question on the video I sent you.
I loved it.
Do you see empowerment on that? Because I wanted to use it, but there was no third party.
There doesn't have to be a third party. There was
or
no third.
There would have had to be.
Yes, for the assignment there would have to be. Yeah, you couldn't have used that for the assignment, right?
Okay.
But it was an extraordinary, extraordinary story. But you could say that, you know, the third party there for the son, for the son was the father. I mean, this father was an agent of empowerment for his son. He was supportive. He was encouraging. He wasn't directing. He wasn't telling. I mean, the opposite would have been the doctors.
So where did the father get the empowerment from?
Ah, very good. Very good. Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, we don't know that from the tape. You would have to say, I would guess, go back to the time when, you know, when the father was finding out about the kid's disability. What happened? Who did he talk to? What happened between him and his wife? Many of you told stories about the way in which, you know, a parent or a brother or a sister helped you talk something through. One would guess that, you know, I told Marianne a story last week about an incident in which my partner, my co-author, there have been 100 of them, we help each other talk through the challenges that get thrown in our face that would lead us to you know, lose confidence as well as become very negative towards our critics, of whom there have been many, right? And we help each other. So, you know, agents of empowerment don't have to be mediators or third parties in that sense. But probably that father didn't just do that by himself. Maybe he had a clergyman. Maybe it was with his wife, his brother, you know. His story doesn't come through on the tape, does it?
No.
It would be a very interesting story here. But it was a great... I really appreciated you sending it to me.
Well, it's the first time I saw it, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Okay. You have a short question?
No, I was just going to ask, do you ever teach the models and relate them to, like, religions? Because all I could think about was, like, the transformative, it sounds kind of like Buddhism, like the same kind of tenets. And then the restorative is like monotheism. I couldn't really think of something for facilitative besides, like, it was like, who was that philosopher, like Locke or something, right? It's like humans,
right?
Like have to be forced in the community or something like that.
Well, the answer to your question is no, I never teach it and relate it that way. And one reason is that I wouldn't want to create a kind of sectarian boundary around this. In fact, that's one of, if you read through chapter 6, that's one of the questions asked there. Isn't this basically the promotion of kind of a religious approach, a spiritual approach to conflict intervention? You can read the answer there. But the truth is that although there are probably some religions that you might identify and actually a lot of people have identified transformer mediation with a kind of Eastern mystical approach to faith. But obviously, it's not my approach, right? I mean, I must relate to this, right?
Yeah.
There are in almost every faith tradition, Mike. Almost everyone, you know, everyone. I don't know about all of them, but there are different approaches to the faith itself that stress different things that might fit into these different categories. So, for example, in Christian thought, about which I don't know a great deal, but there's a very famous theory, a very famous book by a guy called Tawney, called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, which is a very early book written about why America developed the way it did, because of its Protestant religious faith. And the premises underlying that were very consistent with the not the restorative, but the facilitative approach.
I get things done. Right?
That people are essentially, you know, acquisitive, but they lack capacity for this and this, and therefore religion sort of channels them to make them productive instead of destructive. It's a kind of conflict containment theory of religion, if you will. But there are other approaches to Christian faith that have a much more positive view of human nature and the kind of religious institutions that are needed to support the positive aspects of human nature. And so I wouldn't associate any of them with a particular...
I can see how they'd be dangerous in teaching that, but...
It would be dangerous. It would be strategically unwise, and it probably wouldn't be fair. And you would have to know a lot about all of these different faith traditions in which I'm no expert. I mean, I try to stick to what I know. I know something about the political philosophies, right? So Locke, for sure, is, you know, that kind of stuff is, there you go, I didn't touch it. I hope you got the whole thing.
Yep, there you go.